Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, the podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership, and I'm here today with Freya Lockley, Steve Topple and James Wright, three of our brilliant Canary writers. Now, the BBC has devoted an awful lot of its coverage this week to Prince Harry's engagement, as have many other media organisations. So we're going to be looking at what the BBC wasn't covering while that was going on. Then we're going to talk about a food bank opened by a Tory MP. Now, that sounds like quite a strange thing to have happened, so we're going to explore that a little bit. And finally, the vote on animal sentience. This has caused quite some controversy and is, you know, perhaps indicative of some of the struggles that we'll have with extracting ourselves from the EU. So some extraordinary stories this week. First of all, let's start with Freya. Freya, like everybody else, the BBC has been pretty obsessed with Prince Harry's engagement to Meghan Markle this week. But isn't it interesting that at the same time, there were several stories that were, you know, perhaps a little bit more important for the public concern that kind of didn't really surface. Tell us about those.
It was interesting timing, wasn't it? Yeah, apparently on the day of the announcement, Media Lens said that the BBC devoted 50% of the news coverage to the royal engagement.
50%?
50, yeah, and that was according to Media Lens. What's interesting, though, is that the proposal actually happened earlier this month. It was the announcement that was made on that day, almost with quite uncanny timing when you look at the other things that were going on. So, for example, it was only 21 minutes after the announcement of the engagement that the government announced benefits will be frozen for the next 12 months. So in the great excitement around the engagement, this news didn't really break out as headline. It's possible a lot of people weren't aware of it. And people are already struggling. So the impact of the benefits freeze is going to plunge thousands of people further into poverty. But that didn't seem as important as the marriage to very rich people.
And when we're talking about benefits freeze, what does that mean?
It'll save the government around 3.9 billion by 2019 to 2020. But it comes at a time when, especially because of all the Brexit negotiations, prices are rising. And in real terms, I think it's been reported that, I think it was yesterday, that the cost of living in London has risen 3%. It means that those people receiving benefits, their income will remain frozen. And roughly an estimate, and this is for working families, a cut of about £315 a year in real terms. But I think the important thing is to weigh that up against how fast prices are rising, yeah, and not even beginning to think about the chaos that's surrounding universal credit. So a lot of people are going to be a lot worse off. There's no question about it. But that news was just quietly snuck in. And the government are in communication with the palace. So for them to announce that just 21 minutes afterwards, it wasn't that the palace just sprung this on people and it happened by chance. It was a very carefully orchestrated timing of the engagement, certainly, which leads you to wonder why they announced that just 21 minutes later.
And that was all. Funny that, isn't it?
It's such a coincidence, isn't it?
And, you know, it's not like this never happens. You know, there's definitely a precedent for, you know, very important announcements being overshadowed by very popular announcements. So, you know, so far, so true to form. What else?
On the same day, well, the previous day, the Mail on Sunday had really released photos showing that the British Army had been involved in, they'd been secretly training soldiers from Saudi Arabia who will go on to fight in Yemen. this was actually criticised by a senior Tory, Andrew Mitchell, who used to be the International Development Secretary. And the implications of the UK's role in Yemen are being criticised increasingly, as they should be, but still there seems to be no focus on our... We are complicit in a war that has been declared the world's worst humanitarian crisis, partly through our sales of arms to Saudi Arabia, but now it's emerged that we are training Saudi soldiers. And again, you know, that's news that should have received, I think, a lot of people would feel, a broader analysis of the UK's role in the Yemen war, but that didn't happen. Again, it was overshadowed by the news of this royal engagement. And it seems that the general mood in the country is that everyone's had enough of the engagement already. Even the Radio Times has reported that people are, you know, that they're bored of it. And I think, yeah, which I know the most surprising people to criticise it. Yeah. And yet the BBC and all other news sources are still bombarding us with this news. And as somebody said, yep, they're, you know, do we need an announcement to check that they're still engaged? They're still engaged. And just got to wonder how long this is going to go on for and how much they're going to try and hide behind it, because it's been a week of very big news.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we should probably earmark the date of the wedding and just make sure we've got our wits about us that day in terms of reporting the news. Now, that wasn't it. There was yet another important announcement made.
There was more. So the government refused to release a report that outlined the economic impact of Brexit. Though Labour pushed a motion that they should be released. So on the same day, an 850-page document, and this covers 58 sectors. So you can imagine that the full reports would be significantly more than 850 pages. This has been widely criticised because the level of redaction is so huge that what Parliament has been given sheds very little light on what may be going on. And there is talk that Brexit Secretary David Davis could be in contempt of Parliament because of the level of redaction. And again, this dropped out from the news. It wasn't analysed in as much detail.
So let's just for a minute. This is an 850-page report outlining the economic impact of Brexit, which the team led by David Davis has withheld from MPs. So the MPs who are supposed to be debating these issues and looking for, you know, a good way of managing this whole enormous rudderless ship in a sea of treacle are being told that they've got to do that without the information that they need.
Yeah, why? Well, it implies that there may be quite a lot to hide, doesn't it? If they're not being given the information, what is it exactly? Because if there was nothing to hide, surely the reports would have been given over in full for detailed analysis and discussion.
I mean, you'd think so. I mean, you know, this government is getting more and more authoritarian and, you know, demonstrating that with having such little respect for its own MPs that it's not going to provide them with the information that they need to actually discuss and debate this thing. It just absolutely beggars belief. I really, this actually got me reeling probably more than any other story this week.
And the fact that there is this sense that we are that stupid, that where with information is withheld, that everybody will just quietly cower down.
That's right.
And not ask any questions. I keep saying I shouldn't be surprised anymore, but each time I am.
Let Mummy May deal with it all. The little children don't have to worry. They can get on with playing with their toys.
Yeah, and we are literally being kept in the dark about what is coming up through these Brexit negotiations. And initially, Davis had refused to release them, so it was only after Labour pushed a vote and that he was forced to. And again, the government would have known that this was going to be delivered on Monday. on the same day that this engagement was announced.
So the MPs now have had a chance to see this document. Did they get it in good time to discuss the issues, or is this actually a little bit too little too late? Or do you think that actually they'll be able to get on top of it?
Yeah, everybody has been left in one hell of an almighty mess through this. The information should have been shared a long time ago. But coming at this point, nobody can make the decisions about how long is needed, because nobody can quite see what's been hidden. Whether the full papers will be issued without redaction, how long will that take?
So there's still portions that are not visible to those MPs?
Yep.
I suppose I shouldn't be surprised given the track record that this current government has had in its short life, but really, just the lack of respect, that's what really gets to me with that. You know, you withhold vital information from the people that you're tasking with making decisions about this stuff and representing their constituents. How can they possibly do that? Oh, well, we'll come back to Brexit a little bit later on in the show. Freya, thank you so much. Great to actually get to hear those stories. Thank you very much indeed. Next up, we've got another Tory MP who has been doing something a little curious this week. Steve, tell us what Steve Brine MP has been up to.
Yes, okay. So Steve Brine MP, I'm assuming Brine is the correct pronunciation of his name. It's rather fitting as it is, because his attitude seems like he's been stewing in it for years. He did the not so unusual thing of opening a food bank in his constituency of Winchester and Chandler's Ford. Steve Brine proudly announced this on his Facebook page, saying, "This morning I officially opened the new branch of Winchester Basics Bank. We salute its many volunteers. I dropped off my box of goods. Please do the same if you can. God bless them all." I mean, there's some wonderful but rather nauseating irony in the fact that the taxpayers are paying an MP salary who then uses this money to donate to a food bank, which is only there because government policy is so disastrous, and the government policy that's made the food bank be there is to save the taxpayer money. Well, I'll try and get my head around that. However, Steve Brine opened this food bank, and naturally social media was not best impressed. Everyone kicked off saying, "How dare Steve Brine open a food bank? It's disgraceful, because it's his government which are causing people to be there." Interestingly, I didn't put this in the article, but I was handed a response from the Trussell Trust, who oversee these particular group of food banks. It was a response to one of our readers. And they said that they routinely ask MPs of all parties to open food banks because they feel it's important to make MPs aware of what's going on in, if you like, in inverted commas, the real world. That was their reasoning behind it, because obviously there's a lot of criticism of food banks and the people who operate them when they allow MPs to open, especially MPs of a Tory variety, because it just seems completely against the pale, essentially. But as I say, I mean, this isn't anything new. Tory MPs opening food banks. The Scottish Secretary David Mundell famously opened one in 2015, and there was a massive hoo-ha in Scotland around that. So, but it's the fact that another food bank is opening really is testament to the surge in figures, which have all been documented quite nicely.
You know, and it comes to something when you've got to sort of dangle a juicy PR carrot in front of an MP to actually persuade them to engage with and understand the reason that these food banks exist. I understand what the Trussell Trust are saying, but I don't think that's the way.
I understand what they're saying. However, surely anyone with an ounce of sense would realise that a Conservative MP opening up a food bank ain't going to be very good for your PR, and it's certainly not going to do any favours for the Conservative MP in question's PR either, because they could have predicted what the backlash would have been like. I mean, and the thing is, Nancy, obviously, I mean, the figures for food banks are well documented, but just to reiterate, to the listener the scale of the challenge with food banks. The Trussell Trust alone says that since 2010, there's been an upsurge in food bank use from just over 40,000 to 1,182,000. Now, that's an increase of nearly 3,000%. Now, that's 2016, 2017. We haven't got the figures so far for the whole of this year, but that includes up until June. And from January to June of this year, there was a 13% increase alone. What's important to remember with this, because this is obviously just the Trussell Trust's figures.
Okay.
More than half of all food bank use, the all-party parliamentary group on hunger estimates, actually comes from non-Trussell Trust food banks. So this is kind of a tip of the iceberg job, if you like, really, on the extent of food bank use across the UK. Because bear in mind, a lot of them are operated by churches who wouldn't collate the figures. They're operated by small local enterprises. And so this, the Trussell Trust figures are just a tip of the iceberg. And there was an interesting article, interesting for several reasons, out in the Evening Standard yesterday, saying that in London now, food bank use is so rife that 1 in 10 families are relying on food banks across the capital. It was interesting because obviously, who's the editor of the Evening Standard? Let me think. That's right. It's the professor of austerity himself, George Osborne, who implemented the policies which have led 500,000 children to have to now rely on food banks and has overseen a nearly 3,000% increase.
Just to be clear, you know, food banks are not, they're not a kind of a part of somebody's benefits. This is not kind of some sort of imposed retail kind of measure for people who are on benefits. It's not saying, well, we're not going to give you enough money for food, so instead we're going to give you a food bank. This is actually just the fact that people are being plunged into poverty and they are being referred to food banks because the money in their pocket, whether that's money that they earn through doing work every day or whether that's money that they're paid as a contributor to the UK, we are saying that those 1,100,000 people are in a position where they simply cannot afford to buy food. When you bring together the cost of their housing, their heating, their utilities, the things that, you know, you absolutely fundamentally need to live and that are generally at a fairly kind of fixed price. We're saying that actually after that, there is no money left for food.
Essentially, yes. I just need to clarify one thing. That it's not 1,182,000 people that have used food banks. That's the number of three-day packages that were sent out. They estimate that the actual number of people who have used food banks is around a million, with around 500,000 of them being children. So, because obviously people have repeat visits to food bank if they're persistently in poverty. Ultimately what you're saying is correct. There seems to be a perception as well in a lot of the media, well, the right-wing media anyway, that, oh, food banks, people just go into them to claim poverty. You can't just go to a food bank. You have to be referred by the Department for Work and Pensions in a lot of cases to the Citizens Advice Bureau, who then do a thorough check of your finances to see just exactly how poor you are. Are you poor enough to be officially starving? Yes, okay, you can go to a food bank. You can't just turn up and go and grab some beans from your nearest Trussell Trust outlet, if you like. So there is a system in place. But just yesterday, myself and my partner Nicola had a friend come around to say hello and have a cup of tea for a couple of hours. We live on a council estate in one of the 10% most deprived areas in the country. And our friend came around yesterday. She's 5 months pregnant. She has a five-year-old child. She was working, had a job, and she was also claiming tax credits to top that up. Her job finished, and she hasn't been able to get another one since. She declared everything for her tax credits correctly. They worked out that they'd overpaid her because her hours were flat variable, as is a lot of the case with much employment now. Her hours are variable. They change week on week. She gave them the estimates they wanted. It turns out at the end of that financial year, 2016-2017, they paid her too much. So they're now taking money back. They're taking £40 a week back from her off her income support and her child benefits. She's now having to go to a food bank because what they do, they make you pay all your priority debts first, which is rent, council tax, electricity, gas, and bizarrely enough, TV license is considered a priority debt. You have to pay all that first, and then anything that's left is essentially yours, and food is not classed as a priority debt. So our five-month pregnant friend with a five-year-old child is having to go to a food bank, essentially because HMRC didn't calculate her figures correctly. And this is not, I know this isn't an unusual case. You hear this all the time on social media, but this is the position people are being left in. And it's a growing problem. And as the Trussell Trust have repeatedly pointed out, universal credit is making matters worse. They say that in areas where universal credit has been rolled out, there's been a 30% upsurge in food bank usage in the 6 months after it's rolled out. I mean, their figures kind of speak for themselves. They say that 45% of referrals were made because of a wait for the first payment of universal credit. 36% of referrals were made because a new claim hadn't been awarded, and 38% were due to a change of benefits. So the Conservatives argue that, and to play devil's advocate here, that, well, it's increased awareness of food banks, that people are going to them, and it's the fact that the system is more robust with regards to the Department for Work and Pensions being able to refer people. That's the government's line on that. Most of us think it's bullshit, and it is a fact that people are literally not having enough money to feed themselves.
Yeah, given all this, it's just the absolute audacity that someone who's a member of the party that has delivered austerity is then like proudly opening a local food bank as if he's like a local hero. Like saving the day.
There is nothing heroic about that. And there's something deeply, deeply worrying to me about this. I don't know, listeners, if you heard the interview with Danny Dorling a few weeks back, but if people do not have their basic needs met, if people are worrying about their housing being warm enough, being fed, then they have zero economic freedom. The opportunities for people to even consider, you know, starting a business, innovating in some way, starting a community project, volunteering, any of those things that contribute to our society and to our economy, are just, they're just completely out of reach. And the idea that, you know, we have an economic system right now that is very happily and consistently lining the pockets of the very richest in society, to a degree that is like, they don't need more money. You know, there's just no reason for them to be hoarding that, while we have, you know, these people, children who could be, you know, the next incredible parents of the next generation, the doctors, the people who keep the streets clean, the shop workers, the people who are going to come up with the ideas that really take on some of the challenges that we face, that, you know, we can't avoid. Challenges like food security, like energy security, like the changes to our environment. Challenges like, you know, how do we take care of a population that's increasingly aging and infirm? You know, these people are never going to have the chance because, you know, they're worrying about putting food on the table, and these children are not going to have the chance, you know, not least because, you know, they're at risk at having substandard nutrition. We're talking about malnutrition in a country like England, in a country like Wales, in a country like Scotland, Northern Ireland. You know, we consider ourselves one of the big economic powers in the world, and, you know, we've won wars on that basis. But right now, it's just not looking that way.
You say malnutrition. Ironically, Steve Bryan is the Minister for Public Health, and since the Tories came to power in 2010, the number of hospital beds where malnutrition was cited as the reason that person was using that bed has tripled. So there we go. But I think you make important points there. But for me personally, this is all by design. This is not some fluke that these policies are happening and suddenly poor people are not being able to afford food. You see the degradation of of social housing over many years. You see the stripping back of the welfare state. You see the rise of precarious, insecure employment where people are scrabbling around for zero-hours jobs. You see the stripping back of the NHS. You see the appalling states of public rail infrastructure is in. This is not some coincidence. This is all about creating a them and us state, if you like, where a certain group of people can get on and everyone else is scrabbling for titbits at the bottom, essentially. In my opinion,
they're explicitly defending their class interests, basically. They don't just think that, oh, poor people are feckless and lazy.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's intentional ideological attacks on the poorest. Just as a side note, I did a research article this week based on the birth rates for the past 4 years.
Yeah.
And this, my analysis was verified by the Office for National Statistics. They said, yep, you're quite correct. But they said they don't know the reason for it. Birth rates amongst the richest socioeconomic statuses has gone up by 5.6% in the past 4 years. Meanwhile, the birth rates for the bottom four poorest socioeconomic statuses has dropped. And the bottom socioeconomic status, that's grade eight, people classed as unemployed or never have been worked, has fallen off by 33%. Poor people are having less children.
No, that's interesting. We could speculate that that has something to do with the fact that babies cost quite a lot of money. You have to buy them stuff and feed them and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is with research like that, it's hard to quantify unless you do a survey of like 50,000 people across different economic classes. But there could be varying factors for that. It could be the decrease in real terms wages. It could be the health inequalities, for example. There would be the mortality childbirth rates to link into as well, see if poor and rich people, there's differences there. But ultimately, for me personally, it's endemic of what's happened over the past sort of three and a half decades,
yeah.
Where now, as soon as your child turns five, JSA, you've got to go and get a job. That doesn't exist anymore. And of course, that's going to put people who can't afford to raise children without the help of the welfare state, it's going to put them off having children.
Yeah.
There's a new report as well that's shown that 4 million children are now living in poverty, mm-hmm. and 67% of those have got at least one parent in work. And they've worked, I was going to write about this today, actually, that means that 9 children in every single class are living in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Would you think of it in those terms of, like, you know, that's pretty much a third of every class in every classroom across the country, those kids living in poverty.
And it's probably even more than that, because if you consider the fact that there are plenty of classrooms in independent and fee paying schools, in our grammar schools, that, you know, are massively skewed in terms of the sort of economic status of those children. You know, if we start looking at the inner city schools in the more deprived areas, I imagine, you know, that statistic goes wildly up. It's going to be a lot more than 9.
Yeah. And even 9 is shocking enough. Mm. Just, you know, third of every class.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, this is a pretty impossible situation for people, and it just astonishes me that, you know, we're still seeing turkeys voting for Christmas here, and we really have got to get the message out that returning another Conservative government is a surefire way of this continuing.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, briefly, because as Freya rightly alluded to, the poverty figures, if this had been 3 years into a Conservative government, then you could sort of, there's a margin of error, if you like. 5 years in, it would be questionable. 7 years of Conservative-led rule would indicate to me this is no accident. They cannot mess up this badly for 7 years and go, oh, we didn't know that was going to happen, or, oh, we didn't know food banks would increase, or we didn't know 4 million children would be in poverty. It's nonsense. This is not accidental that this is happening now. Like I say, 3 years you could say it was, 7 years later, nah, it's not accidental.
Well, and we know from history, you know, austerity is not a new thing. We are, you know, by no means the first nation to be experiencing it, and you know, that what you described, Steve, is exactly what has happened in African countries, in South American countries, you know, in the past, during the 20th century, when austerity was invented, really. So, you know, it should be no surprise that that's the outcome. You know, speculating over the motivations of those people is really difficult, but you know, this can't be a surprise to anybody. I completely agree. So what can people do, Steve? How can we try and improve this situation and get rid of austerity, other than voting in not a Conservative government, voting in a Progressive government?
To be honest, it's getting very difficult. I will give you a perfect example. The People's Assembly did a demonstration last week about food bank use, the fact that it's rising, and about the relation to universal credit. They planned this for weeks and weeks and weeks. It was a coordinated demonstration in London with local demonstrations across the country. They delivered 12 tonnes of Trussell Trust food to outside the gates of 10 Downing Street.
Wow.
Great PR exercise. I was chatting to the organiser on the phone and I said, it's brilliant, great idea, lovely. And they did a demonstration in the evening. About 100 people turned up for this demonstration. It was an absolute, it just bombed. And that to me is really worrying, because when an organisation like People's Assembly, with the reach it has, can only muster 100 people to come out, it's either a sense that there's some apathy now to the fact that, oh, well, it's just happening, what can we do about this? We've tried protesting, blah, 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 what else can we do? Or that, well, oh, it's winter, we can't bother to come out, and it doesn't really affect people that much. I'm not convinced that the national demonstrations where you march from A to B are having any sort of effect. There's been so many of them now, and nothing's changed. There's been countless People's Assembly demos, countless NHS demos. What's happened? Tories have ignored them. So I think the push now has to be towards more localised action, if you like, because that's where you see results. When people do focus on specific issues within their community, it's at grassroots levels where you can affect local change. We're going to struggle to change national government because, for varying factors, not least because national government is so intrinsically linked to global corporations that you're talking about taking down the whole system to really affect change. But at local level, you can make changes. There
Absolutely.
Are those great local organisations you can get involved with. The links will be in the show notes for this, I'm sure. And also, you can find them on Facebook. If you look on my Twitter, other people's Twitter, we're always sharing links to local groups. One perfect example is an organisation called Streets Kitchen in London. Their motto is solidarity, not charity. And they organise people to cook and then feed for the homeless population in sort of three target areas of London, Camden, Islington and Hackney.
Yeah.
And it's just loads of people getting together. It was formed by people who used to be rough sleepers. Loads of people getting together and just literally helping, not just going, well, here's a check every month, getting out there and actually doing shit. And I think it's now to the point where we have to organise local level to start affecting change where we can in our local areas. And regarding changing things nationally, I'm not sure what else can be done. Like I say, protest doesn't seem to be working. Court cases, however, are having more success in certain areas. In others, like with fracking, for example, the court route is absolutely getting nowhere. The situation is pretty dire, let's be honest. But locally, I think that's where we can actually do things and start affecting change.
I think it's really great to look at what's going on in your local environment. And it's actually an opportunity to try new ways of doing things. Many of the kind of innovations, many of the economic changes that may be possible in the future will come from that. We've got some great stuff around. You've got the Transition Town movement.
I was about to mention them.
Like places like Bristol, Totnes, where people have established a local currency which stays kind of within the businesses in that area, as well as lots and lots of local actions and activities like you're describing, getting together and actually sorting out some of the problems in our communities. So there's plenty that people can do, lots to get involved with. And the more of us do that, the more of us demonstrate that we want the world to work in a different way than, you know, this neoliberal capitalism that we, the flavour of neoliberal capitalism that we have, which is, you know, it's a distinctive flavour and it's a nasty flavour, and, you know, with a government that's becoming more and more authoritarian by the minute. So all is not lost.
So I was going to say as well, it seems like in the face of this, I'm seeing a real sort of resurgence of community action and people coming together to actively start to change things. Mm. And I'm really hoping that maybe that's the seed of change. I mean, in Cornwall, though, for example, there's a children's clothes bank, which was started up just by one woman. There's a repair cafe. So for people who can't afford to replace things, people in the community are coming together, sharing skills. So you can take something there to be repaired rather than replaced.
Which is great for the environment, too. I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah. I just really hope that maybe that is the answer, is the rise of community in the face of all the crap that's coming our way.
Yeah.
Could that become a strong enough force for change?
Yes. I think also is that people feel that Corbyn is kind of on the brink of power, and that is the first concrete step, the first, like, clearest step towards change, and that anything else in politics right now is a bit of a footnote. Yeah. To that happening, and people are kind of just hanging on for that. So I think that might be why there's maybe a bit of apparent apathy right now after so many years of elections as well.
Thank you very much for taking us through what Steve Bryan has been up to with his food bank, and the wider discussion that we've been having is really interesting. Unfortunately, it is not only people that this government is having a go at. It seems that they're also having a crack at animals this week. I mean, really, this strikes me as a little bit strange that we'd be talking about a vote on animal sentience this week. James, how on earth did this come about?
Okay, so it goes back to an amendment that Green Party co-leader Caroline Lucas tabled last week, which was an amendment to the EU withdrawal bill, which is the bill for essentially transferring EU legislation onto British legislation. But what Caroline Lucas wanted to ensure was that EU law within the Lisbon Treaty was honoured by the UK after Brexit, which is essentially a law that recognise animal sentience. But every Tory MP and the DUP voted it down, which led to the perception that they do not recognise animal sentience, because if they do recognise it, why not recognise it in law?
And what do we mean, just taking a step back, what do we actually mean by animal sentience? What does that phrase actually conjure?
Well, it's that animals are conscious beings that have a degree of emotions and feeling, that they're not completely different in kind. They're not just kind of robots going around, that they do experience feeling, essentially, which is quite clear, I think, even if before you go into the science. But the government does maintain that it does recognize animal sentience, and it argues that it's already protected within the Animal Welfare Act 2006.
This is a really interesting kind of, I guess, paradigm example of the mess that we're in with the idea that we leave the EU. I personally was involved in discussions when actually a new EU directive came in a few years ago about animals in research and agriculture. And actually, it's absolutely correct that the UK standards surpass the EU standards in that case. And I still am personally of the opinion that having the EU directive in place is a good thing, because it means that, you know, we could never slip back any further than that. And, you know, the welfare standards that we have in the UK, the way that we treat animals who are working for us, essentially, is only as good as it is because people said, we want this to be better. People put pressure on to improve, to replace animals in research, to refine research, to actually reduce the numbers at the very least. And also we called for better standards in agriculture. When we're talking about leaving the EU, we're talking about making new trade deals outside of Europe, and particularly with the US. And we've already heard all about Liam Fox's chlorinated chickens. Now, that might sound quite funny that, you know, we're talking about washing our chickens in chlorine before we eat them. But, you know, that's not something that ever would happen in the UK. But were we to make a trade deal with the US, we may have to consider, you know, doing that kind of thing either for stuff that we're exporting to US market or accepting those standards for food that we're importing. Right now, I don't feel like I want to trust this government to actually say, well, you know, EU or no EU, we're going to uphold these standards. It seems, you know, this vote is indicative of a kind of attitude that seems kind of inconsistent with that.
Yeah, Caroline Lucas kind of backs it just because, well, she wants to say that future animal legislation should be based with animal sentience recognised as its backbone, whereas the government is just like, oh no, it doesn't matter. But I think the government also just like doesn't want to get what it views as defeated on the EU withdrawal bill.
Yeah,
seems to be a bit adverse to accepting amendments to it.
This is just one issue that we'll be dealing with as we look to withdraw from the EU. You know, we heard earlier on about the fact that MPs don't even have the information about the economics of withdrawing from the EU that they need. There's lots and lots to unpick. There's lots of legal stuff. There's lots of the way that we, for example, deal with intellectual property and copyright. But probably, you know, most worrying are, you know, the potential changes to the way that we relate to our environment and to how we deal with the changing environment. Now, you know, if we're going down this line of making closer and closer economic relationships with the US, you know, we could really have a problem on our hands because, you know, we all know what the attitude of the Trump administration is to climate change. So ultimately, we're still in the situation where we don't know what a post-Brexit world will look like. We don't know how we're going to get there. It seems very unclear as to when certain changes will happen. And yet, you know, the government still is pursuing this on the basis of a very weak mandate. I suppose I kind of live in hope that, you know, at some point either we have a change of government or everybody realises that it's, you know, it's far too complicated and more hassle than it's really worth. And we don't end up doing it, or we at least end up with a second referendum. But I don't know how likely that is.
I think maybe it's more likely that we have another general election and Labour ends up standing on a Remain platform and it becomes a sort of a general election with a referendum added in there for extra fun.
Let's keep our fingers and toes crossed. And in the meantime, we can look at some of these local activities, these local campaigns. We can look at the unseat campaign. There are some marginal Tory seats that are being focused on. There are several very high profile members of the Tory party and the cabinet actually involved in that. So, you know, we have got a chance to get the likes of Boris Johnson out of office entirely. So lots and lots to get involved with. And it's, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. We've got hope. We're building communities. We're trying new ways of doing things. And that's incredibly positive. I think, you know, that's the way that we're going to show that there are other ways of being in the world and other ways of taking care of each other and other ways of, you know, creating value rather than wealth. So thank you so much for this week's podcast. I've been talking to Freya Lockley, Steve Topple, and James Wright. Thank you so much, team.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, you know, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with another Canary Pod. Please do remember to rate, review and subscribe to Canary Pod on iTunes or your favourite podcast platform. That's the best way of spreading the word about Canary Pod and getting more people listening in. So, see you next week. Until then, don't get angry, get involved.